Hello and welcome back to Franklin Covey's twice weekly podcast on leadership with Scott Miller. That's me. I serve as your host each week, 6 years running 350 plus episodes, where every Tuesday and Friday we release podcast episodes, both in audio and video format, in the hopes of investing you as a better leader. Franklin Covey, of course, the most trusted leadership firm in the world, 40 years plus in the business of helping people become more highly effective, helping people build greater cultures of trust, identifying their key goals and building strategies and behavior change and alignment with them. We love to build and partner with organizations that are truly invested in their most precious asset, which of course is their culture and their people. And so every couple of episodes, we like to kind of swing the pendulum back to a core leadership topic. You can't have 350 episodes only on leadership. I guess you could, but not this podcast. And today we have a seminal Wall Street Journal best-selling author back in the house, metaphorically. His name is Joey Coleman. You may know him as the author of the best-selling book, Never Lose a Customer Again. Well, Joey has done it again and released another book in that series titled Never Lose an Employee Again. This book came out about 9 months ago. The tagline is The Simple Path to Remarkable Retention. Joining us from outside of Minneapolis, Joey Coleman, welcome to On Leadership.
Scott, thank you so much for the kind introduction. I am beyond excited to get to spend some time with you today. Been a big fan of Franklin and Covey before it was Franklin Covey both, and so super thrilled to be here today.
I thought you were going to say you were a big fan of Scott Miller, but you'll hold that to the end. It's okay.
We'll see how it goes. By the end of the conversation, I will like you, but we'll see. No, I'm just teasing. Scott and I had plenty of banter before we even started today.
Joey, I feel like I'm looking in a mirror. I'm delighted to have you and your energy and your passion on this program today. You know, one of the things that Stephen M. R. Covey talks about is that, this is, of course, Dr. Covey's son. He wrote the seminal books, The Speed of Trust and Trust and Inspire. He talks about how, you know, there's a couple of important jobs that leaders have beyond mission, vision, and values, beyond systems, structures, and strategies. One of them is to give people feedback on their blind spots, which I think is one of the top two things leaders sometimes abdicate because they're high courage conversations. And another is the ability to recruit and retain quality talent. You have dedicated the better part of your last couple of years researching, writing about, perfecting, and publishing a book about retention. And I think we all fall into this trap naturally as leaders, where we're so focused on recruitment and recruitment and recruitment, where we often abandon what is as or more important of that is, how do you build a culture where people choose to stay? How do you build a culture where people choose to give their best and they want to refer their friends in? And so today we're going to spend the better part of our interview based on what is your methodology and your research and expertise around how do leaders focus on retention. Now, you had a bit of an epiphany, because as you were researching for this book and as a speaker and a coach yourself and an author, you found a lot of people had a similar challenge in life. And when you kind of reframed that challenge into a solution, you realized you'd hit something. You share this in the opening of your book. Will you take a few minutes and kind of recap first who you are and how you got to write these books? And then will you answer this question around what was the issue everyone was struggling with, and what was your aha moment on what the real solution was?
Well, for the last 20 years, Scott, I've helped companies around the world keep their customers and keep their employees. I do that as a keynote speaker, as a consultant, and as you mentioned, as an author. And what I realized, particularly as it related to employee experience, is that I would work with organizations around the world. I've had the pleasure of speaking on all 7 continents, consulting with clients of every industry and every size you might imagine. And there was a common lament from leaders. And that lament was, I wish my people cared as much about the business as I do. Now, here's the thing, and I say this respectfully, knowing we have some incredible leaders that are watching and listening to the show. I knew these leaders well enough to know that they really cared about their people. But the way I reframed this to those leaders was to say, and your people wish you cared as much about them as you care about the business. See, lots of times as leaders, we are so focused on how are we growing? How are we innovating? How are we bringing new products and services to the marketplace? Without necessarily stopping to pause and say that none of this would be possible if we didn't have incredible employees. You can't deliver a remarkable customer experience if you don't have remarkable employees who are ready to deliver that experience on behalf of the organization. So this led me on a multi-year research project where we looked at companies small, medium, and large, online and offline, product and service, domestic and international, over 50 case studies from all seven continents. And what we found is that the majority of businesses over-index on getting employees, recruiting employees, hiring employees, as opposed to retaining employees, getting employees to stay for the long term, getting them engaged, keeping them engaged so that they become raving fan advocates of your business.
I mean, the business case is pretty obvious, right? I mean, I like you, have authored a few books on leadership and careers and mentoring, and I remind all of the clients that I speak to that every one of their employees right now is being recruited by somebody. Every one of your employees is in some level of conversation, serious to sort of frivolous, around what else is out there, what else is possible, might someone like me more, might I be happier somewhere else. Every employee, especially your top performers, including your entire senior leadership, executive team, and C-suite, they're all being recruited by somebody, typically your competition, and if they're really valuable, they're probably getting multiple overtures a day on LinkedIn. And you have to decide whether or not you want to inoculate them against those overtures, because you're naive if you don't think people are doing that, because most of your competition can afford to pay your people $8 more an hour or $15 more a year or 2% more commission because you've done all the hard work of training them, educating them, maturing them. Talk about that, because you write in your book pretty passionately around, in many ways, you're kind of setting your competition up to poach all your people. What are you doing, A, to acknowledge that, and B, to inoculate them against taking these phone calls?
Well, and here's the kicker, Scott. We want to set our people up to be poached. We want them to be growing. We want them to be learning. We want them to be succeeding. That's who's going to get poached. They're not going to poach your worst employee. They're not going to poach the employee that you have on a performance improvement plan.
We wish
you're like,
they were.
Oh, I'm not sure they're going to be here 10 weeks from now. They want the best. And if you're the type of operation that fosters the best and grows the best, there are going to be those external overtures and invitations from other employers, come work for us. I'm a big fan of research, Scott. And one of the things that I came across when researching this book was that the typical research that has been done on why an employee leaves has a sample set of somewhere between 250 and 500 employees. Now, if you know anything about statistical relevance, you know that a study that has a sample set of 250 to 500 employees is probably not that robust of a study. Instead, I found some work by the Work Institute where they had done research of 240,000 exiting employees across 17 industries worldwide. And when they looked at all of these industries, one of the questions I had, because I'd heard this from CEOs, is, well, my people are leaving for more money somewhere else. I wanted to figure out why they were really leaving. And the research showed that indeed, 9% of employees leave for a better deal somewhere else, more money somewhere else. But that got me curious, Scott. Why did the other 91% leave? And what the research found is that 23%, almost three times the number of people who left for money, left for a single reason. And that reason was they couldn't see a clear path forward at their organization. They didn't know what their next job and the job after that was if they stayed. So they entertained the overture or the interest or the invitation from another organization that clearly charted their path forward. So if you want to do one thing to inoculate your people, to convince your people that staying is a good idea, it's to regularly have conversations about what staying looks like and how staying will advance their career, their title, their role, their responsibility within your organization, what's available. That's the best way and the fastest way to keep people on board.
Joey, take that a bit deeper. That's remarkable. The other 60% of reasons, were they pretty scattered amongst 100 things, or was there something next that was quite compelling that leaders are thinking about or should know right now?
I would say the thing that leaders should know right now is one of the second reasons, which I forget, when they originally did the research, I think it was at about number 4, it's moved up to number 3 and it's growing, is this idea of flexibility. Post-COVID, the employees have learned that the emperor has no clothes. And what I mean by that is for years, employers, and I say this respectfully, said, you got to come to the office. You got to work 9 to 5. We need you to punch this clock. We need you to work in this setting, in this environment. And what the COVID pandemic taught the planet really is that a number of jobs, the majority of jobs, don't have to be done or completed within the bounds of a physical geography, nor do they have to be done or completed within the bounds of a temporal border. So what I mean by that is employees can work from home. They can work from the coffee shop. They can work at 11 o'clock at night instead of 11 o'clock in the morning. And the employers who are willing to be flexible with their people, that are willing to create systems and structures that allow their business to operate, but acknowledge the human desire to be different, the practical reality that different people work better in different scenarios and settings, those are the employers who will increasingly be the employer of choice, ready to get whatever talent they need from anywhere in the world.
Joey, your book is titled Never Lose an Employee Again, The Simple Path to Remarkable Retention. It's organized around what you call the 8 phases and tools of a remarkable employee experience. They are in order: assess, accept, affirm, activate, acclimate, accomplish, adopt, and advocate. I'm going to take a deeper dive on a couple of these, but before I do that, you talk about how there's a time frame where you have a chance to get the employee experience right, and I'm going to have you share that time frame, but and why is that the time frame, and what does that mean to get it right? But will you rewind, and for those who may be thinking about what does the term employee experience mean, define that. I think everyone now knows what the customer experience looks like, but few people are talking about the employee experience. Define that and talk about that time window and what it means to get it right and how do you lose it.
So by employee experience, Scott, I'm talking about all the things that contribute to how an employee feels about working within your organization. These can be the hard touch points, if you will, of what does the employment contract look like? What do the procedures look like? What do the processes in your business look like? As well as the softer touch points of what are my coworkers like? Do I have coworkers or colleagues? How do I navigate my interactions with people? Does this feel like a psychologically safe place to work? Or does this feel like a sweatshop? What are the elements of those interactions? What are those touch points? What are those feelings? All of these things, think of it as an umbrella combined to create the employee experience. And what the research shows is that the first 100 days of the employee journey, the first 100 days of their experience, are the most important time frame in the entire relationship. If you get the first 100 days right, you have long-term engaged employees. This research has been proven from Harvard Business School, Stanford Business School, the Department of Labor in multiple countries. What we find is that employees who come to an organization and have a strong onboarding process, a focused onboarding process, especially across those first 100 days, are more retained, are more productive, and are more engaged, which at the end of the day, it's kind of the goal, at least of every business leader I've ever met. They want their people there. They want them engaged. They want them contributing. They want them producing. These things all happen and happen incredibly well if we lay that foundation in the first 100 days.
Joey, take us on a quick journey. Think of it maybe in terms of a litmus scale from the most simple and practical things you can do to make someone's onboarding experience dynamic to something maybe a little more cultural, not ethereal, but I'd love to have you maybe give us a couple of plots along that line so people can leave this, A, wanting to learn more in the book. We'll talk about the actual architecture of the book and the experience in just a moment. You've done some cool things there. Walk us through 6 or 8 points along that continuum that everybody can leave today thinking, gosh, we don't do that, or we could do that better, from easy to a little more investment?
Lovely. So let's look at a couple of the specific phases in those eight phases you mentioned. The first one let's dive into is the accept phase. This is when you extend an offer, and if you're lucky, your desired candidate accepts the offer of employment. Now, in the typical organization, with all due respect, and I'm a recovering attorney, so I feel like I can take it to the attorneys a little bit. Recovering attorney means you've admitted you have a problem. There's 11 steps after that to kind of work through it. But here's the challenge I have. So many offer letters look like they were written by a lawyer. Now, I'm not opposed to lawyers. Lawyers play a very important role in our society. But an offer letter shouldn't feel like a memo from a lawyer. It should feel like an invitation to the next chapter of your life. In the same way that we might get a wedding invitation in the mail and we open it up and it's got handwritten calligraphy, and inside that envelope, there's another envelope, and we open that envelope and there's another envelope. It's like the Russian nesting dolls of envelopes. By the time we get to the invitation, we're feeling excited about this event, the wedding. We're feeling eager to want to accept the invitation and send back our RSVP and be part of the celebration. What would it be like if a new hire employee received that kind of invitation instead of the typical form letter? The next phase I want to dive into is that affirm phase. I'd be willing to bet that everybody who's listening is familiar with the concept of buyer's remorse. What they might not be familiar with is the concept of new hire's remorse. Now, new hire's remorse is the same thing as buyer's remorse. It's the scientifically proven fact that immediately after accepting the job offer, that newly hired employee will begin to doubt the decision they just made. And this is probably the area where most businesses globally fail. They get the acceptance of the job offer. The employee says, I want to start in 2 weeks. And the next time that employee has any interaction with their employer is when they show up for the first day on the job. This is a fundamental problem. It's a missed opportunity, because in that space between accepting the job offer and showing up for the first day on the job, all that employee is doing is doubting their choice. Maybe I should have negotiated for a better salary or better benefits. You know, I was interviewing with a couple different places and I accepted this offer, but I hadn't heard from that other place. What if their offer was better? I kind of liked that job better, but I took this one because I wanted to make sure I had a job. Oh, what am I going to do? And all of that fear and all of that doubt and all of that uncertainty, if not addressed, if left unchecked, leads them starting the relationship when they come for the first day on the job in the hole. They don't feel good about their choice. They don't feel good about their decision. And we're trying to dig them out of the hole as we bring them into our onboarding process. The last example I'll give you, because you asked for three, is to think about this idea of the first day on the job, or as I call it in the eight phases, the activate phase. And in the activate phase, I want you to remember the immortal words of country music legend Bonnie Raitt when she says, let's give them something to talk about. Now, why is that important? Well, we know for a fact, and we've probably all had this experience ourselves when we've taken on a new role or a new job. We work that day on the job, that first day, and then we go home that night to our spouse, to our parents, to our children, to our roommate, or if we live alone, maybe we call a friend or connect with them for a FaceTime. And the first question that our loved one is going to ask is, how was your day? How was it? How your employees answer that question is more dispositive of whether they will stay, whether they will be engaged, whether they will be a contributing member of your team in the future, than any other question we could ask them. If we know for a fact that they are going to be asked that question by their loved ones, shouldn't we as the employer be more strategic in how we structure and plan that day to give them something to talk about? I think it's a good choice.
Joey, recognizing that we have a broad variety of listeners and viewers and subscribers to this podcast, right? I mean, there are parish ministers that have 8 or 10 associates. There are high school principals. There are college provosts. There are chief learning officers and chief financial officers. Every possible position in every size organization, Fortune 5 to Russell 2000. Including entrepreneurs. Who owns this? Is it the leader? Is it the hiring manager? Is it human resources? Is it people services? When you consult with organizations, recognizing that it's different per circumstance, who typically should be owning, if nothing less, the communication between the time you're offered the letter and the 2 to 3 weeks when you begin, and the first day experience? Where does that responsibility rest?
Well, interestingly enough, Scott, you've hit the nail on the head with this question of who should own this responsibility. And one of the fundamental problems that most organizations have is that no one owns it. And no one owns the entire journey.
Yeah.
Sure, we may have the HR department is doing the interviews, and we bring a manager in once we get to the, you know, second or third level of interview, and they decide, and then they show up for the first day on the job, and HR kind of does some briefings or some conversation, and then they quickly get dumped to the manager, and the manager really has had no training on how to manage people. This is a fundamental problem with most managers. They've been promoted because they were good at doing the job, good at doing the task, not because they were good at managing people. And now we hope that they're responsible for it. But don't worry, HR is here in case we need to parachute in if there's a problem or a crisis or a complaint. And we really don't have anyone in the organization who wakes up in the morning, looks in the mirror and says, what am I going to do today to make this the best place to work? Now, who should own this, Scott? I would posit everyone in the organization. Eventually, the goal we're moving towards is that everyone on the team realizes that they contribute to the overall experience. Because how I interact with my colleagues and my coworkers and the other people in my department is just as relevant to that employee's overall experience as how the human resources or people's team deal with them, or how the CEO deals with them, or how a direct manager deals with them. So I think we want to move towards everyone owning it. In the beginning, when you are growing, it needs to be owned by the leader. And the leader can bring in additional support if the leader is less of a people person. Although if you take pride in saying you're less of a people person, I'd like you to spend a little time in quiet self-reflection to see if that's really a good way to navigate your time here on earth. But I do think there's an opportunity for us to take personal ownership of those roles and responsibilities and collectively work as an organization to make sure we're delivering the best possible experience we can.
It seems to me that it should be a combination eventually of people services, human resource, whatever you're talking about it, helping to map the process and everyone along the way knowing what their touch point is, with a tremendous amount of responsibility being on the hiring leader, right? We know people don't quit their jobs. They quit bad leaders and corrupt cultures. And your book is you have mapped the employee experience process through tons of research and client interviews. I mean, literally the book can be the Bible for how to create what's right for your organization and focus as much time on recruitment as you are on retention or vice versa. Speaking of which, in your research, Joey, in your book, you share a lot of stories of other companies and what they're doing right and what they're doing wrong. Are there a couple maybe examples where you might pluck from clients of yours or research studies where you'd say, hey, XYZ company does this, that's best of class, that can be replicated at an ice cream shop, at a gym, and at a preschool. What are a couple of things that are best case scenarios that are replicable in any setting?
Scott, you jumped right to one of my most favorite aspects of the book, and frankly, something that was really important to me when I was putting the book together. There are over 50 case studies in the book of companies of all sizes. You mentioned earlier that we've got folks that are running teams of 2 or 3. We've got folks that are running teams of 20 or 30,000 listening to our conversation. There are case studies in the book for you. And in fact, at the beginning of the book, I have a chart where I break down all the case studies by number of employees and revenues, so that if you're the kind of person that says, well, I want to see some examples of other $2 million companies with less than 10 employees, great. We break them down and you can cut right to the chase on those case studies. When it comes to examples that are portable across every industry and companies of every size, let's talk a little bit about the wonderful team at Jamf. and what they do on the first day on the job. Because I mentioned the importance of giving them something to talk about. Jam's a company based outside of Toronto that runs sport and social clubs. So think of this, if you have like a kickball league in your community that everybody plays in after work, or a softball league or something like that, they help run and organize those leagues. It's a place for young people and middle-aged people and old people to meet other friends, colleagues, have some sport, have some social, have a good time. When you show up for the first day on the job at Jam, you pull into the parking lot, and you are met at your car door by your manager. You don't have to walk to the front door and walk into a receptionist and make sure you're in the right place and you don't even know, and do they know you're coming? No, no, no. You're met at your car door. And the reason is because the team already knows the cars in the parking lot. They know which one's different, and they also know you're starting that day. And they want to make sure you have someone to walk you to the front door. When they open the front door and you come into the building, you hear music pumping, and that music is your walk-on music. If we think of professional athletes, lots of times when they come up to bat or they're called onto the field or the court, they'll have a theme song, some walk-on music that plays. And Jam is playing your walk-on music. Now, how do they know it's your walk-on music? Well, in the interview process, they ask you if you were a professional athlete and had a walk-on music song that they played every time you came onto the field, what would that be? They ask you in the written application, but they never ask you about it during the interview. That's intentional, because you've probably forgotten that you shared it with them. And all you know is when you come in, you hear the beat, you hear your jams, you're feeling excited, you're feeling pumped. You turn the corner and you see a hallway that is lined with all the Jam employees. And they're wearing hockey sweaters or hockey jerseys, for those of you that don't play hockey, with their name on the back and the number, the logo of the company on the front, and the number on the back of the jersey is the year that they started working at Jam. And you walk through this high five tunnel, high fiving all of your new coworkers and all these people you're starting this journey with. And you come into a boardroom, and as you look on all the TVs on the boardroom, they have virtual conferenced, video conferenced in all of the Jam employees from around the world. So the entire company celebrates your first day on the job. You haven't been in the office for 15 minutes and you are already feeling welcome. You are already feeling embraced. You are already feeling celebrated. Now, I get that not every one of you has multi-million dollar budgets for new employee onboarding experiences, or the ability and the time and the resources to put somebody through a university program at your organization where they do 30 days of training and learning before they actually take their seat in the organization. But every company can make those first 15 or 20 minutes on the job feel like a celebration of the new hire.
Your energy is contagious. I'm delighted we chose to showcase you and your book today. You wrote a book that is a very interesting reader experience. I've written seven myself, read a few from the set behind me. And in fact, my day job is I'm a literary agent. So I'm in books all day long. But you've done something quite remarkable in terms of how you wanted the reader experience to be, very intentionally. Will you take a minute or two before we close out and talk about when someone buys the book in any format, what is the reader experience going to be like for them?
Well, Scott, if I was going to write a book all about the importance of creating remarkable experiences, I thought it would not only be appropriate, but interesting to explore the experience of the person consuming the book, whether they're reading the hardcover, checking out the ebook copy, or listening to the book on audio. And so what we did is at the very beginning of the book, you can sign up to experience the book. We ask you a series of questions. How quickly do you think you'll read the book? A couple days, a couple weeks, more than a month. We then ask you to provide some information. And for each piece of information you're willing to provide, your name, your email address, your cell phone number, your physical address, for the additional items that you're willing to provide, we then create some fun interactions along the way that are paced and timed to match up with your reading. So you'll get a message from me checking in on what you thought of the last chapter you just read, or you'll get a message with a video from me encouraging you to pay attention to this next section of the book. We have a bunch of little surprises put in throughout the book. What I will say, author to author, that I have loved about this is it has given me a pathway to connect with my readers. One of the things I love about being a speaker, I come off stage, people come up and they ask me questions. Oh, Joey, what about this? How would you apply it in this? And I get that human-to-human interaction. With a book, while I'm certainly excited that people are consuming the content and hopefully finding benefit and value in the frameworks I've provided and the examples I've given and that they're taking the next step to implement these things in their business, if they have a question, if they have a curiosity, a concern, and I haven't created an easy path for them to communicate with me, it's a missed opportunity. I'm thrilled to say we have had readers from over 80 countries sign in to experience the book. And that has given me the opportunity to connect with folks all over the planet, see how these ideas are working in their small town or big town or giant mega city, and have that type of connection with them.
I am so jealous of your genius because you are clearly an expert on what it means to create experience. As you were talking just now, I was thinking, okay, so our chief people officer, our vice president of literary, our CEO, I was thinking of all the people that need to watch and listen to this interview, like tonight, before it's edited and ready to go in a week from now, I was thinking of how I'm going to email all the people at Franklin Covey, you need to listen to this interview because Joey Coleman is a genius. The book is Never Lose an Employee Again, rides the wave of the success of his previous book, Never Lose a Customer Again. Joey, I'm thinking there are a lot of people right now that are Googling your name because they're thinking, okay, beyond the book, how do I get this guy to consult with our company's onboarding process? Take a moment at my invitation, talk about your company and in what capacity do you actually consult or speak with companies about how to refine their customer and employee journey.
Scott, thanks so much for that kind invitation. Yeah. If anybody's looking to learn more, it's real simple. Just go to my website, joeycoleman.com. That's J-O-E-Y, like a baby kangaroo or a five-year-old, you know. Coleman, C-O-L-E-M-A-N, like the camping equipment, but no relation. What you'll find there is there are three main ways that I interact with audience members. They can read my books. They can bring me into their organization as a speaker or a workshop facilitator, or they can hire me to consult and dive deep into how to make the journey that your customers or your employees are having even better tomorrow than it is today. We work with companies small, medium, and large around the world. I spend about two and a half to three weeks of every month on the road doing keynotes and on in-person workshops. I also do those things virtually, and I work with about a dozen companies a year on more extended consulting projects where we really dive deep into all the minutiae and all the touch points that are creating your experiences and figure out ways to make those better.
Joey, when I say this, I always say it off air, but today I'm going to say it on air. You crushed this episode. Thanks for your time today. Joey Coleman, appreciate you joining us. The book is Never Lose an Employee Again, The Simple Path to Remarkable Retention. Look forward to having you back for round three, whatever is next for you. And we'll see you back here.
Oh, thank you. I was just if you wanted me to close out, Scott.
Go ahead.
Thank you so much. It was absolute delight being a guest on the show. Love everything about you and the work that you all are putting out there. And I hope everybody who is listening in got an idea or two that they can implement in their organization to make that employee experience better. I promise you, time spent paying attention to the people on your team is the best minute-for-minute return on investment that you will ever experience in your business. I wish you great success in the first 100 days of that experience and beyond. And if I can ever be of service, don't hesitate to reach out.
Prior to my 25 years with the Franklin Covey Company, I spent 4 years with the Walt Disney Company in Orlando. And when I was interviewed for a real estate community development job, the human resource vice president asked me, Scott, what song best represents who you are as a person? And to my wife's now horror, But to then, my genius, I said, well, Gloria Estefan's, get off your feet, get up and make it happen, or get on your feet. And so I'm teased about that, but I'm just like picturing it, me walking in and Gloria Estefan like rocking and me being horrified that that was my, it would now it'd be Macklemore, something like, you know, raise your hand.
There you go,
like
there
anyway.
You go. I
Joey,
love
thanks for
it.
Having you it. On. Appreciate you and your time today. And we'll see you back here next week for a new conversation on leadership.